Scripture lesson for this evening's sermon comes from the Gospel according to John. I'll be reading from the 15th chapter, verse 9 through verse 17. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And you are my friends if you do what I command you. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing, but I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you. And I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. I am giving you these commands so that you may love one another. Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. They say context is everything. Who are they? I don't know, but I think whoever they are, they might be right. For example, a person could say the exact same words but do so in two different contexts, and they might hold entirely different meanings. Let's try it. Suppose you show up to visit a dear friend or a relative that has been extremely ill, and once you enter their hospital room, you say, "I hope you are doing well." Those words might carry a completely different meaning than the exact same words in passing. You know, the sort of small talk we do in America when we often see each other, the customary kind of greeting for a friend you may well see every single day who's quite healthy and quite vibrant, and yet you bump into them at the store, probably near the beer, and you say, "I hope you're doing well." Same words, different contexts, lots of possibilities for variations on their meaning. We've been exploring the dance as a bit of a metaphor because, well, quite honestly, I'm not a good dancer for this sermon series, so it has to be a metaphor. Dancing can have so many different meanings as well. The same activity, but when done differently or at different occasions or in different contexts, it could have profoundly different meanings. For example, when your very favorite song, you know the one, comes on the radio that you just can't keep from either singing along with or tapping a toe or even dancing, most of us from the waist up if we venture that far, you know, you do a little lighthearted, you're feeling a little lighthearted and goofy, it just catches you at the right opportunity and you do a little sort of dance, that's using it loosely compared to what it looks like on me. It has a very different feel, though, than the dance that two newlyweds might do the day of their wedding at their reception, having their, quote, first dance together as a couple. Newlyweds, they might be cutting up and acting silly and goofy, too, but even though all of that might be going on, there's a certain sense of formality, there's a certain sense of hope that this is not the last dance, this is the first dance of many to come. That's what we wish for all those couples. Doesn't always work out that way, but we wish it for them. The Gospel according to John is very unique in that it almost always carries with it a sense of double context, double meaning. In a way, the writings in this Gospel kind of have multiple layers. This Gospel is very different than the other three, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We call those the Synoptic Gospels. And part of John's distinct difference from the others is that the author had a different theological agenda. But the other part is that it was written approximately three generations after Jesus' ministry had concluded. So when we read John's gospel, we hear its words sounding in two different eras, two different contexts or settings. First, we hear the words unfolding as a narrative that tells modern readers about Jesus' unfolding ministries, the stories of our faith, and John's author tells these stories. But the second context, the second hearing, when we look a little deeper, is we also feel the imprints of a community of Christians some three generations after the time of Jesus who have been wrestling with many aspects of their own faith, even as they're narrating these stories and putting them together in this book. And they're trying to make sense of their own faith journey. Where do we start? How do we make this work? How do we put this together? They probably were wondering and had a great deal of doubt about themselves because, you know, after all, why had Jesus not returned yet? They are all taught that very literally. Why, as followers of Jesus, did they still have to endure trials and tribulations and deaths at the hands of their enemies and being placed into captivity and all the rest? They were likely doubting themselves even as they assembled these stories of our faith and put them in one place. So, you can see why context would matter when the author puts these words on Jesus' lips. Abide in my love. Abide. Now that's a word, I don't know about you, but I don't go around using it a lot. But abide has a very special significance for people who feel as though they're hanging on to faith by a thin thread. Abide is not a word we use very often, but the word here, abide, is meant to encourage those who were reading it, members of this third generation of the Christian tree, to hang on to faith, to keep on keeping on, to find that deep, lasting connection to love and to God and to the teachings of Jesus by continuing to practice them and live them out. I am so glad the author didn't say, now listen, you want to abide? Here's how you do it. Keep on agreeing on the right propositional truth statements about the right kinds of ideas about God and Jesus, and that's how you'll abide. I wouldn't make it very long. And yet that's how so many Christians attempt to live out our faith, right here between our ears. So we end up trapped, overthinking things, instead of doing something deeply authentic and meaningful and just living the part of the teachings of Jesus that we know out and finding that deep sense of abiding connection to who we truly are and to who we can be when we follow the way of Jesus. It's actually far more simple than we make it sometimes. Do what we know to be right, and we'll find our way home. We'll come home to ourselves. We'll come home to God. We'll recenter ourselves in a healthy and sustainable way if we just learn to abide in love. And then the next thing the author puts on Jesus' lips in John's Gospel are especially important. Again, they're laced with a sort of double meaning to our modern ears as well. There may be even a third level, which we'll talk about. The author writes, puts on Jesus' lips, I have said these things to you so that my joy might be in you and that your joy might be complete. Now, just hear me out. Now, joy, I'll be honest, it's not one of my favorite things to discuss. Why would you not want to talk about joy? Because there are so many misconceptions about joy. You know, remember the double meanings thing, the different contexts I've been trying to tell you about? Joy can be the same way. One person might experience the joy of a moment when they're having a really good day and things go well. Now, I tend to believe that's more happiness than joy. It's very temporary. But there might be someone else experiencing a much deeper, more complex, and more profound joy. Take, for example, the kind of deep, abiding joy that cannot possibly can be confused with happiness. When, let's say, an adult son or daughter goes to visit their elderly parent or grandparent who has been suffering for months with cancer, who has lost tremendous amounts of weight, who has been in a terrible amount of pain for months, and who is now on their deathbed. Think of the deep, abiding joy that adult child might feel when their terminally ill parent finally passes away. I'm not talking about happiness. I'm not talking about being glad that they're now without their parent. I'm talking about the deep abiding joy knowing that their loved one is no longer suffering. There's a certain sense of joy way underneath the surface, knowing that our loved ones in those situations are no longer suffering. If you've not experienced it, you may in due time. It's certainly a sense of sadness, but the joy knowing they're not suffering is a deep, authentic, abiding joy. Can you just imagine, again, the double context I've been talking about from John's writings as Jesus told his disciples those words? I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. Joy? You see, at the time these words were being spoken, death and torture were drawing very near in the life of Jesus. And Jesus is here talking about joy, complete joy, true abiding joy, right in the face of death and torture. Now, the second context of those words are the third generation Christians who are wondering just how much of the teachings they've missed. What is it they've been doing wrong? They must have blown it since they're still having to just hang in there, it seems, by a thread, and they've not been bailed out. But there's a third context to these words. Today, there's the context that causes our denomination, the United Church of Christ, to say something like, God is still speaking. And here and now, as disciples today of Jesus, the Christ, we read these words, I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you, and so that your joy may be complete. And as I said, I think it's incredibly difficult to have open dialogue and conversations, let alone preach sermons about joy, because right off the bat, I'll confess, I have never mastered the art of being joyful all the time. For another thing, as I said earlier, joy can often be misunderstood as happiness and viewed as something shallow and fleeting and temporary. But I don't think that's the kind of joy Jesus was talking about when he talked about this deep abiding joy. So let me ask you, where do you find your joy in your life? Where do you experience a deep abiding sense of connection to who you truly are, to God, to your faith? I'll confess, I don't have lots of specific 1, 2, 3 tips for you today. I struggle to figure this out for myself many days, but I think these kinds of honest questions are helpful. Where do we experience the deepest sense of joy along life's journey? Now, I think for those with an eye and a heart for social justice, joy can be a particular challenge. Because once a person becomes aware that injustice is not just a series of isolated events, but rather several systems, countless systems, perpetuating things like poverty or discrimination or racism, the full gamut of all the systems at work that are perpetuating very heartbreaking situations, it becomes incredibly difficult for many of us with an eye and a heart for social justice to work against injustice while simultaneously experiencing deep abiding joy. That's a challenge. And yet, by Jesus' own teachings, I think it's not only possible, but vitally important in life's journey. Now, I'll confess, and I may get in trouble, I doubt here, that as I listen to our president give advice on the National Day of Prayer, on praying and spirituality and theology, on the same day that the story changed 3 times of how much or when he paid off the porn star, or if he did, or if someone else did, and whether he knew, that kind of hypocrisy paired against one another, I didn't feel very joyful. I still don't, I'll be honest. I also don't feel very joyful, do you, when you look around our Oklahoma legislature and you realize that for basically 3 weeks our legislators ignored teachers, and then in the dark of the night passed a bill that could discriminate against single families or gay or lesbian or same-sex couples from being able to provide a loving home to foster care, children in foster care, or potentially adopting these children. I can't see how more children without homes or discriminating against anyone is a good thing no matter how you feel. In fact, I call those kinds of things joy suckers. They just suck it right out. In fact, if I want to ensure a good case of heartburn, all I have to do most days when I'm driving to and fro in my pickup truck is just leave the radio turned on to the news. Because with every heartbreaking story, I have this Gospel of John kind of double meaning thing running through my head. Who's getting hurt now by this bad news, and who's going to get hurt in the future? Who's getting hurt? Someone's getting hurt when people do stupid things who are supposed to be looking out for the public's best interest. Does this kind of thing ever happen to you? Am I the only one? Do you ever feel so burdened down sometime by the weight of the world's injustices and problems that you almost forget what it must feel like to have joy? I think Jesus' disciples must have felt this way. The more they learned about being compassionate people who were tuned in to what was really going on in the world, the more weight they must have felt from it all. The more Jesus taught them about being people of compassion and joy, the more tense things were getting at the same time, because people began to turn on Jesus, who were in charge, who were in power. Add to the burdens of the world our own burdens that we carry. And let's just be honest, joy sounds pretty far-fetched, because when our finances get tight, when a marriage dissolves or is suffering, when parenting exhausts the last bit of positivity in our entire bodies, joy? Really? That sounds so shallow. Can we just talk about surviving instead, we say? But the truth is, we don't have to choose between joy and just surviving another day. We've been programmed to think we have to choose between joy and just surviving, but we really don't, because the kind of joy Jesus was talking about is not the surface level fake smile kind of thing that should be confused with could be confused with positive thinking or mere happiness, but instead authentic, deep, abiding, centered joy comes as we give and as we experience and receive love. Now listen to these words again. I want you to listen for the word joy, and then I want you to hear what came next in the Gospel of John. I'll read it to you again, these couple of verses. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. And you are my friends when you do what I have commanded you. I think what Jesus would want us to remember about joy is that the greatest joy we can experience in life runs well beneath the surface of our life's immediate circumstances. We spend most of our time looking for joy right at the surface level. Shallow kinds of joy. That's why we buck it when we hear it, because we've actually been looking for it and are quite skeptical. But deep, authentic, abiding joy is down deeper. I thought about it as I prepared today, and I think it's kind of like rivers. You know, rivers right on the earth's surface, for example, are easily seen. We get in our car, we go someplace, we drive across a bridge, we read the name of the river carefully marked there, and we're really not surprised. It's lying there in plain sight. Duh, we say, it's a river. Big deal. They're supposed to be there. I'm supposed to see them. It's got water in it, or it's run dry, but it's supposed to be there. Duh, it's a river. But there are many rivers beneath the surface of the earth. Some of them we call aquifers, which in many cases take life-giving water to more people and more places and go completely undetected by most of us. In fact, we take them for granted often. These waters flow in the deepest, darkest recesses of the earth, out of sight and mostly out of mind. And some of us simply go and turn on our faucets and never realize the waters that we're relying on have come from deep under the earth's surface. They're not out under a bridge. They're not out on the surface. They come from down deep. So we give them no acknowledgement, But I think of these cool, dark waters when I talk about joy. I think it's the kind of deep, abiding joy Jesus was talking about. See, just like joy, we don't make or create these underground water supplies, but they definitely exist. But rather, we discover they've been there right underneath our feet, right underneath our proverbial noses all along. We just awaken to the fact that they've been there, sustaining us, sometimes nourishing us, sometimes even bathing us. As a parent of two near teenage boys, I'm in favor of that bathing. But you see, joy is not found by setting out to find joy like those above ground rivers. But rather, joy is the byproduct of what happens when we lay down our lives in love for our friends. Joy is always the byproduct of self-giving, self-sacrificing love. It's much, much deeper than surface level stuff. So to return to the metaphor of dance, maybe we've been waiting to dance until we felt the joy in our bones. But maybe the joy won't ever come until we put these old bones into motion before we feel it. Loving, caring, serving, advocating, befriending. What if the joy is the journey itself and not a destination? What if joy has been there all along below the surface of our circumstances? I wonder, could we hear it? I think I hear something. I think I hear the rhythm of love, and it has a beat that's contagious. It's called joy, pure, unadulterated joy. So my friends, may God surprise us today by opening our eyes to the joy that is already present underneath the surface of our life's circumstances, whatever they may be. Amen.